Welcome to The Gods We Belong To, an urban fantasy noir podcast. The Gods We Belong To tells one continuous story in order, and it's important to start at the beginning. So, first timers, it's back to episode one for you. Now, my faithful friends, take a beat, take a breath, and let's check in with Alex. Chapter 5. Several hours of intensive online research yielded a flood of dubiously reliable info about Odin and all things Norse, but absolutely nothing of interest about Elizabeth Bettany. All the usual details were there: born 1980 in Pasadena, attended college at UC Santa Barbara, where she studied philosophy, and then a few boring corporate jobs before landing at the Church of Individuology about a year back. She'd been promoted quickly, several times, and was now the church's director of operations, not to mention the main man's main squeeze and fiancé. Not a bad few years' work for Miss Bettany. But Odin was right. There was something suspiciously bland about her. Her entire past seemed to have no rough edges, as though she'd been gliding through life without actually coming into contact with it. Even her appearance seemed perfectly designed to blend in. Pretty, but not too pretty. Goldilocks, golden mean. I was hitting a brick wall. Fortunately for me, as the non-famous fiancé of a very famous person, Miss Bettany was the ideal subject of a human interest story. The kind of juicy hometown girl shite that makes great grist for the media mill. That gave me an in. The perfect cover for a good get-to-know-you session. I called her office at the church, told them I was a features editor at a big local rag, and that we would just love to do a candid interview with the bride-to-be. Give the world the chance to meet the real Elizabeth Bettany. The church had always been fairly tight-lipped with the press, but recently under Miss Bettany's influence, Michael was preaching a new, more open engagement. I figured he just wanted to make his creepy cult seem less creepy and cultish, but apparently the goal was to let the world really get to know the church and the beauty of its teachings. At least that's what Tiffany, Miss Bettany's assistant, told me as she enthusiastically accepted my request for an interview. It took a little more skill to rush the booking. I told her our very best writer just happened to be in town, but only for one more day, and given the impending nuptials, we wanted to get this to press ASAP. It's a good thing I'm such a charming son of a bitch. We were on for an 11 a.m. meeting the next day, a little early lunch at a swank, secluded spot in Hollywood. I pulled up at the valet parking stall a few minutes before 11 a.m. The restaurant was just two blocks off Hollywood Boulevard, but it felt like a different world. A vine and flower-covered arch marked the entrance and continued back over a long pathway. Then a left turn ushered me into a tranquil, dimly lit space, the brick walls alive with ivy. I may have been a few minutes early, but Elizabeth Bettany already looked well settled in. She was seated elegantly at a private corner table, dressed in a simple but clearly expensive outfit, slim-fitting gray skirt, white shirt. She had a pretty face, like I said, but not holy shit pretty. Her red gold hair was short, I think they call it a pixie cut. It suited her high cheekbones, pale skin, and large bright eyes. She stood as I made my way over to the table and extended a hand in introduction. "Elizabeth Bettany, pleased to make your acquaintance." She didn't even stare at the eye patch. Pretty and polite, this one. I decided to adopt the patch full-time after my experiences with Michael. Avoid any inadvertently overwhelming ocular freakouts. I took her hand, suddenly realizing that I'd neglected to come up with a name for this fake journalist cover. "The pleasure is mine, Miss Bettany. Jonah Jameson." "Okay, I know, but it just popped out." I shook her hand and smiled warmly, hoping to hell she wasn't a Spider-Man fan. She smiled back, no hint of suspicion. Score. One more in a long list of successful lies. I took a seat and pulled out my mini-recorder, as any real journalist might. I also wasted no time hailing the nearest waiter and ordering an Irish coffee. Between the caffeine and the booze, I hoped one of them would take care of the headache I felt brewing behind my eyes. It wasn't bad yet, but I had a hunch it was headed that way, and I couldn't afford to be even a little off my game here. "I hope you don't mind, but I've taken the liberty of ordering for both of us," she said with a slight grin. "The lobster and truffle risotto is simply not to be missed." That did sound good, I had to admit, probably what I would have ordered anyway. She clearly took my hungry eyes and approving smile as consent and moved on. "Before we get started, Mr. Jameson, I wonder if you wouldn't mind excusing me for a moment. I'd love to freshen up." I wasn't sure just how much fresher she could get, but I nodded and said, "Of course, Miss Bettany." She rose and rounded a corner toward the restrooms. The waiter delivered my Irish coffee, and I eagerly drank it down, waiting for the soothing relief I was sure would follow. No dice. Not only that, but now there was a fly, a large horsefly nonetheless, buzzing around my head with irritating persistence. I shooed and swatted, but only succeeded in missing the fly and smacking myself in the face. Finally, it seemed to lose interest, and not a moment too soon, as Miss Bettany came strolling round the corner and reclaimed her seat opposite me. "So," she said with a smile, "where shall we begin?" "Let me switch this on," I said, pressing record. "Don't want to miss any of the good stuff." "By all means, Mr. Jameson." "Well, congratulations for starters," I offered. "The big day is getting close. You must be very excited." "Oh, you have no idea," she beamed. "I mean, it's not every day a simple girl from Pasadena marries a man like Michael Enderley." "It certainly isn't." I'd known Elizabeth Bettany all of 5 minutes, and I was already sure if there was one thing she wasn't, it was simple. "I don't know anything about Church of Individuology weddings," I continued. "There's not exactly a wealth of information out there. Anything particularly unique about the ceremony?" "Not really. The language is a little different, more church-specific, but we don't sacrifice a goat or anything like that," she joked with a coy smile. "Okay," I chuckled, smiling back, despite the mounting pain in my head. If I didn't know better, I'd say she was flirting. I tried to ignore it and keep up the act, just ask more questions, anything to start her talking. "What about last-minute preparations? Is the final stretch a frenzy of activity for you, or is it all anticipation until the big walk down the aisle?" "There are a few loose ends left to tie up, nothing I'd want to bore you with. You know how it goes, no matter how painstakingly you plan, something always pops up at the last minute. But that does nothing to dull my anticipation." The way she said anticipation made my pulse jump, but I wasn't sure if it was aimed at me or if there was just something a little Jessica Rabbit about her that made even innocent comments sound like innuendo. Either way, I was here for information, and it was time to start collecting. I unleashed a polite barrage of personal and professional questions, mostly the usual interview fare, but with a few twists of my own designed to dig deeper. I've conducted a ton of interviews over the years, and I've gotten pretty damn good at the game. It's all about getting the subject to open up, usually not that hard. Most people are just dying to talk about themselves, and given any excuse, they'll spill far more than they mean to. But not this one. Not Elizabeth Bettany. Don't get me wrong, she answered every question, no deflection, and answered them with enthusiasm, wit, and charm. Tons of charm. There was something undeniably slyly seductive about her. Not overt, no crass comments, lip-licking, or suggestive handling of food, but still I felt a persistent pull, a nagging sense of desire, like a small, steady itch I couldn't scratch. I tried my best to ignore it and carry on. I am a professional, after all, so still I asked, still she answered, and still she revealed nothing more than exactly what she said. There was no hint in her at all of hidden shame, regret, or secrets closely kept. Of course, the fucking headache wasn't helping either. Now it felt like something clenching inside my head, particularly behind my patched eye. Note to self, ask Odin about this spectacular side effect of his magic mod. We ate and talked for about an hour. Apart from the throbbing pain in my skull, my stunning lack of progress, and the constant effort it took not to imagine my dining companion naked, I was doing great. Actually, in spite of all that, I was not having a terrible time. Elizabeth Bettany may have been a frustrating subject, but she was certainly pleasant company. And she was right, the risotto was almost worth the headache. As we awaited our final round of coffee, mine still Irish, she excused herself for another trip to the ladies' room, and that fucking horsefly was suddenly back, dive-bombing my head like a tiny kamikaze. I tried to swat the little bastard without dealing myself another blow, but this only seemed to make it angrier. The fly took a long dive at my face, and this time it landed a solid hit square between my eyes, delivered a vicious bite, then took off, apparently satisfied with its work. I yelped in pain and clapped a hand to my forehead, trying not to notice all the other diners eyeing me distastefully. I'd never been bitten by a fly before, but this one packed a wallop. There was already a small welt where it got me, and it was clearly noticeable, since the first thing Miss Bettany said upon her return was, "My God, Mr. Jameson, what happened to your face?" The pain of the bite joined forces with my headache in a duet of cranial misery as I said my goodbyes to Miss Bettany, retrieved my car, and drove off. I made my way back down to Hollywood Boulevard, steering with my left hand while my right furiously rifled through the glove compartment until my fingers closed around a small prescription bottle. I pulled it out and shot a glance at the label just to be sure. Check. Vicodin. After a brief battle with the childproof lid, I popped one pill and washed it down with a swig of the stale coffee still sitting in the cup holder. Driving past a seemingly endless succession of shitty strip malls and fast food spots, I lit a joint and tried to smoke out the wretched aftertaste of stale Java and focus on the faint at first but growing sense of blessed relief that was slowly driving back my twin pains until I felt almost human again. But there was something else bugging me, so to speak, something about that strangely persistent fly. It reminded me of something I couldn't put my finger on, and I made a mental note to look it up. But the warm glow of Vicodin and weed somehow sapped that thought of all its urgency. Back home, I listened to the interview again, searching for anything I might have missed, any hint of a lie or even a moment of hesitation. Nothing. Conversation flowed from her mouth like music from a virtuoso's instrument, so I listened again. And then again. Four more times before I finally realized I was listening just to hear her voice. It was entrancing, her rhythms and cadences, like a primitive, seductive music. I exhaled a thick plume of smoke and slipped into a half-waking dream. The world faded, dim and distant, and there was only Elizabeth. I could feel her all around me, our bodies entwined like lustful serpents, undulating, writhing, coiling, impossible to tell where one ended and the other began. My mind was flooded with her, her eyes, her skin, her scent, the feel of her warm, sweat-slick body against mine, and the blissful, enveloping oblivion of being inside her. Then the first flicker of fear, somewhere deep inside the ecstasy, small and slight, but nagging. And growing. Fear that, losing myself in her completely, I would be truly lost, unable to find my way back, and as that flicker grew to a flood, there was no more Elizabeth, and blissful oblivion gave way to the bleak and yawning void of Odin's journeying, the abyss we traveled through. Only now Odin was nowhere to be found, and I was alone, adrift in endless emptiness, slowly ceasing to be. And then the phone rang. I shot awake with a scream, covered in sweat, my heart racing, still feeling the mute, helpless terror of the dream. Relax, Alex. This was no time to let my imagination get the best of me. Plenty of real horrors to deal with. On the bright side, I wasn't being gradually dissolved into the great void, so that was nice. I fumbled for the annoyingly persistent phone buried somewhere in the disaster area that was my bedroom floor. "Hello?" I croaked. "Hello, Mr. Cassander." It was her. I knew her voice immediately. Hell, I'd been listening to it most of the night and dreaming about it for the rest. But how the fuck did she find me? How did she know my real name? I stammered for a second, uncharacteristically at a loss for words. "Don't act so surprised, Mr. Cassander. Alex, yes? Did you really think I wouldn't do some digging into my interviewer, especially after you asked such thoughtful and probing questions? What, I asked myself, would make him push so tenaciously, work so hard to coax me open and tease out my secrets, and all while trying so hard to seem so innocent? Only cops and detectives dig like that, and you're definitely no cop. Too stoned for that. Damn, thought I was passing that off so smoothly. Then it was just a matter of figuring out which dick for hire you were. You're not as under the radar as you think you are, Alex. Okay, I swallowed hard before continuing. So you've got me dead to rights. I'm no journalist. She chuckled softly. I also have a good idea of who you're working for. I doubted that. It's Michael Enderley, isn't it? Come again? I don't know exactly what I expected her to say, but it was most fucking certainly not that. Still, I turned it over in my slightly dream-fogged head and decided it was a mistake worth encouraging. Yes. I tried my best to sound like I'd been found out, my secrets undone to the core. I mean, obviously he had you investigated thoroughly by the church's people, but he just wanted someone a little more independent and unconventional to take a look. Sometimes even I was amazed at how easily lies came to my lips. Yes, well, that's why I'm calling you, Alex. I thought I heard her voice falter for just a second. Was that nervousness? I believe I'm being followed, day and night, and watched in my home. It's been going on for about 2 weeks now. I don't know exactly why I'm trusting you with all this, except that I need to trust someone. My fiancé is a rather controlling man. I've always known that, but I told myself it was simply part of being a powerful and important person. So many responsibilities. I guess I never really understood how far he'd take it. Has anyone threatened you? I was immediately surprised at how protective I felt, like I was defending a puppy, which she sure as hell was not. No, nothing like that. It's just those church cronies of his everywhere I go. To them, I'm not a true believer. I came to work for the Church of Individuology because it was a job, a great-paying job, and I've risen quickly there because I'm good at what I do. Still, there are those in the highest levels who will never accept me because I don't share their fervor. I have faith in Michael, not some dogma. Never mind that I'm a woman breaking into what has long been a boys' club. No doubt they are whispering venomous words in Michael's ear, warning him not to trust me, to have me watched, followed, investigated. Michael Enderley is a good man. He would never order such a violation of my life without their pernicious influence. Are you sure Michael Enderley is such a good man, Miss Bettany? I wanted so badly to warn her, to scare her off, make her run screaming away from Michael, the Church of Individuology, all of it. But I couldn't tell her even a fraction of what I knew. She'd just think I was a loon and chalk up everything I said to pure crazy. Please, Alex, call me Elizabeth. And yes, I am confident that I know Michael quite well, far better than he thinks I do. Though I appreciate your concern. I was hoping you might find it in your heart to help me. You needn't do much, just make a glowing report to your employer. Tell him that after a most thorough inquisition of his betrothed, even a die-hard cynic like yourself couldn't help but be moved by the depth and sincerity of my affection for him. Well, I sure as hell wouldn't use those words, but don't worry, Elizabeth. I've got you covered. It felt oddly chivalrous volunteering to lie for her in a conversation that would never take place with a man I wasn't actually working for, who wasn't even a man at all. Life was certainly simpler when I worked for bikers and whores, but it was also a lot less interesting. Thank you, Alex. Her voice was soft, hushed, almost purring. I feel better already. Talk soon, I hope. And she hung up, leaving me feeling more than a little dazed and still trying to make sense of everything, which was proving harder than usual. Generally, all I needed was a good smoke and a few hours to wrap my head around any situation, certainly any job I'd ever worked. But this was different, so much muddier, and my ever-growing erotic obsession with Elizabeth Bettany wasn't making it any clearer. I could have stayed up until dawn, beating my head against the wall, getting nowhere but angry. Instead, I took what seemed like the wiser path, by which I mean a Valium, and passed out. This has been The Gods We Belong To, Episode 5. The Gods We Belong To is written, performed, edited, and produced by Dan Goldstein. Theme music is I'll Drive by Daniel Birch. Additional episode music, Passed Out Drunk and Then It Disappeared by Daniel Birch, and Depressed Buddhist by Unheard Music Concepts. If you enjoyed this episode, please help spread the word. Tell a friend, better yet, tell several friends. You can even tell an enemy if you want. Post, tweet, shout from an open window. Skywriting is particularly effective. 5-star reviews are also particularly helpful and appreciated. However you do it, thank you. You can find the show on Twitter at Gods We Belong To. Episode 6 is coming in just 1 week. So, until then, don't do anything Alex wouldn't do.